Our first matter up this afternoon is case number 85990, State of Nevada versus the 8th Judicial District Court with Mr. Brown et al. As the real parties in interest. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'm going to try to reserve about 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, so as you know, all that'll happen is the yellow light will come on. You'll hear the tone at 3 minutes. If you keep talking, the time keeps running.
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Connor on behalf of Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services. This court should grant the petition in this case and issue a writ directing the district court to enter judgment in favor of Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services for two reasons. First is a plain application of Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 50E, and the second is the application of this court's doctrine of the law of the case and the mandate rule. Starting with Rule 50E, the language of that rule is plain on its face. It presents an exception to the general rule that an appellee needs to file a cross appeal to seek affirmative judgment on appeal, and allows the party, the appellee, when the appellant has challenged the district court's denial of a motion for judgment as a matter of law, to raise arguments seeking a new trial in their answering brief on appeal without the need to pursue a cross appeal.
To be clear, though, you did not move for judgment as a matter of law on behalf of Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Associates with respect to your argument that they were not properly named as a defendant to counts 1 and 3 of the complaint, did you?
We moved for a directed verdict on that issue, and this court treats a motion for directed verdict the same as a motion for judgment as a matter of law.
I understand that, but you did not ask for that relief in your written motion, which was filed in the appendix in the other case at 2299. That's not the relief you requested. You requested that Ms. Scalani, and I'm probably mispronouncing her name, be removed and that the injunction be undone. But I went back and looked at that. You did not ask for JMOL or directed verdict on the grounds that they were not a party defendant to the remaining claims in the case.
We did raise that in the motion for directed verdict, and the court ordered written briefing on that and denied the motion. So, but regardless, the focus of our argument here, Your Honor, doesn't turn on the pleading issue. Our argument here turns on this court's determination that Brown failed to prove the necessary element of damages, and that in footnote 9 of this court's order of reversal, the court recognized that the parties stipulated that Brown's proof of damages would serve as proof of damages for the entire class. And this court recognized that stipulation is binding. And because this court determined that Brown proved no damages, that should have been the end of the case.
What do you do with the special verdict form that references a party rather than Brown? It looks like that followed the oral exchange with the court on Brown's number being the same as each plaintiff's, because it talks about 6, if you answered yes to any of the subparts of question 5, were any patients, plural, harmed by Ms. Scalani's breach of duty? 7, if you found that any patients were harmed, please state a figure which you find would adequately compensate a person for the suffering and harm that you found.
I think the special verdict form at this point is irrelevant, Your Honor. Because of what this court said in the prior appeal. And that folds into our argument on law of the case and the mandate rule.
But actually, the majority was leaning into Brown's deficient proof of sufficient injury to make the claim. And I think it's hard. It's a hard question, but it looks like it went further. There were other plaintiffs who testified at trial, and they were alluded to in the dissent, and it went back and forth. And I appreciate that what you're saying, but the majority is really focused on Brown's proof, I think, not the proof as to the other plaintiffs.
But that is the point, is that the stipulation is binding on those persons as members of the class. So
what do you make of their argument that it was a failure of proof as to his harm, and the stipulation ran only to the amount of damages, which seems to be consistent with the way in which the special verdict was framed?
I disagree with how they framed that, because the entire point of that stipulation was to avoid mini trials, allowing each member of the class to present evidence on damages. But also, if you accept their framing of the stipulation, this court determined that the value of Brown's damages claim was zero, because he did not prove that he had any damages. So if the value of his damages was zero and the stipulation was only that everybody else's damages, regardless of whether they could prove they suffered any harm or not, the value of their claim was zero, then that's the result of that binding stipulation.
Has this case continued in district court, notwithstanding the pendency of this writ, or has everything stood still?
No, we stipulated to stay the case pending resolution of this writ petition.
And why shouldn't we let the district court finish its work and take it on direct appeal?
Because,
in other words, why is a writ appropriate?
Because, one, this court, although I recognize the case that we cited, is an unpublished decision, but the mandate rule is jurisdictional. The district court does not have jurisdiction to do something that is inconsistent with the mandate of a prior decision of this court on appeal. We've already tried this case.
How do you square that with our case law that says that a general order of reversal leaves litigation in the situation it was prior to the entry of judgment?
I'm not aware of a case from this court that says that, Your Honor. This court in the Lobu 2 case rejected that proposition.
Well,
we cited as a Lobu 2 in our petition. It's just cited as Lobu in the reply.
Yeah, but prior to Lobu was Guisti, which is a case that says, and then we have another case, Canepa, that both say that that the general order of reversal leaves litigation where it was prior to the entry of judgment. Because in Lobu, there was a remand, right? And then it was the question there was whether the district court had exceeded the scope of the remand.
Correct.
Which is a little different than what we have here.
So, and I think that this folds back into our argument on Rule 50E, and that the point of Rule 50E is to notify parties, that the appellee, when the appellant challenges the district court's denial of a motion for judgment as a matter of law, the time to raise your arguments for a new trial as well, if you want to try to argue that the record supports the verdict, is to raise those in your answering brief on appeal, because the implication of a reversal of the denial of a motion for judgment of matter of law is that the district court should have granted the motion and entered judgment in favor of the moving party. And so here, where there's just a reversal and no other instruction, the implication of that is that the district court got the motion for judgment as a matter of law wrong and should have granted that motion and entered in judgment in favor of the moving party.
Can you give me a cite to the judgment as a matter of law that you keep referring to, because the one I found doesn't ask for the relief that you attribute to it, that would in turn trigger 50E.
It was raised as a motion for directed verdict, which this court's case law treats the same.
Where is the cite for that?
Where's the cite for that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this court decided that on appeal. That was the whole point of the prior appeal, Your Honor.
No, I think the point was that there had been a summary judgment order. I don't know whether there was an oral 50A motion at the conclusion of the proof, but the 50B motion, and I get that they're not mandatory unless they're going to the sufficiency of the evidence, and then you get the Ginsburg case from SCOTUS in 2011. That's out there. But I don't see a 50B motion at the conclusion of the case that would raise the issue that you're alluding to. The only 50B motion was on behalf of Scalani, and then as to both with respect to the injunction order.
That's, you know, so this court's decision and the prior appeal resolved the question of whether or not Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. That was the result of this court's prior decision.
I think it held that they weren't a proper party defendant to the pleadings.
We argued that, and this court agreed, but it also, in the alternative, held that Brown failed to carry his burden of proof on the essential element of damages. So that's important because even if this court decides that Rule 50E doesn't apply here because we didn't preserve the issue of pursuing a written 50B motion, if 50E doesn't apply, law of the case and the mandate rule still apply. And the district court is bound by this court's mandate, which was to require entry of judgment in favor of Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services because Brown failed to prove damages.
So if the district court substitutes a different party representative, how does that impact all of that?
Well, that's why the stipulation here is really important, because the stipulation is binding on the class. And that also goes to, you know, this was certified as a class action. If you look at the district court's order granting class certification, which you can find at the respondent's appendix at pages 41 to 48, specifically pages 47 and 48 of that order recognized that the class was being certified, that the judgment, whether favorable or not, would include all class members, and it provided for the parties to provide notice to all of the class members.
And after the trial that preceded the prior appeal, the amount of damages that was awarded to Mr. Brown by the jury, albeit was reduced because of statutory limits, that same amount was then ordered by the court in favor of all the class members. Is that right?
That's correct.
Before the case came up on appeal and this court found that Brown had not sufficiently established damages.
Correct.
And noted the stipulation that all the other class members agreed to get the same amount of damages.
That's correct, Your Honor. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Yes, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Marin, and I'm here together with Alan Lichtenstein. He and I, together with Ms. Kathleen Williams, tried this case and have been in it since, I think, 2013. I'm a little grayer, I think, through the process of the litigation.
I think we can all relate to that.
So we're not here to relitigate the sad history of this case, but rather to determine if there are any doctrines in law or equity which restricts the trial court's ability to allow amendment of the pleadings to allow the case to go forward to be decided on its merits. And what was just addressed, I think, is rather important, and that is two things. First, the jury verdict, the special verdict, and also the stipulation. I'd like to just highlight those at the outset, because the jury's special verdict, interestingly, focused on the agents and employees of SNAMS and said that the agents and employees breached their duty
And Mr. Marin, was Brown 1 at all ambiguous with respect to damages?
Was what
ambiguous? Was Brown 1 ambiguous with respect to the fact that no damages had been proven?
Well, the stipulation referred to all members of the class getting the same amount of money that the jury awarded. There was no consideration of what ultimately the Supreme Court would do to the decision of the jury. So the stipulation...
But the majority held that the panel, that the Brown was the named plaintiff and that Brown's damage claim failed. Their point is that's the end of the story.
Well, the jury didn't find that his complaint failed. The jury found that agents and employees had in fact violated their duty, both as to the duty to return indigent persons.
Counsel, we're not going to re-argue the prior appeal, right?
Of course not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm just saying that what the stipulation related to was what the jury found. But
the stipulation was subject to appeal, correct?
The case was subject to appeal. The judgment was subject to appeal. But I think it's important to try to understand what the court meant when it reversed the judgment. And the judgment was entered by the district court after receipt of the special verdict. The special verdict was, as I started to say, that agents and employees had breached their duty. The court then applied respondeat superior, and that concept to frame a judgment. And the judgment said that SNAMS, as the employer of the agents and employees of the hospital who were found to have breached their duty, was liable together with Ms. Scalagna. And the next part of this story is that the representation after the verdict and after the judgment was that it was duplicative against Scalagna and SNAMS to have both of them in after the verdict, after the judgment, and therefore the Scalagna should be dismissed. And it was only after that that this court decided that SNAMS had never been named as a party. Well, in fact, they were never explicitly named in the negligence claims.
We're not re-arguing that today, counsel.
I know you're not. We're not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that that we interpret the Supreme Court's decision to mean that the failure was to name them as the employer, that even though agents and employees, tort liability makes their employer liable under vicarious liability and respondeat superior, the failure to name them in those claims meant that there was a failure of proof, that it was a pleading problem. Okay. And that's why.
And you think that this court, the majority, sent it back to get a second bite at the apple, redo your pleadings, redo the trial, and pretend the first one never happened?
No, but I think that the concept of doing substantial justice means the court didn't say enter a judgment for SNAMS, and it couldn't, because if under the court's opinion, SNAMS wasn't a party, how can a non-party get judgment entered in its favor?
Is it your understanding, I just want to clarify something, is it your understanding that in the post-remitter proceedings in district court that Judge Denton intends for the case to be retried, that's the idea, is that it's going to trial again?
Well, I think that there's very interesting questions as to how the litigation would proceed. And I think I can say a few things that I think could happen. Once we've been permitted to proceed, we filed an amended complaint. Now, presumably, a lot of the issues that were decided initially are going to be the application of collateral estoppel would, in fact, settle many of those issues, so that any subsequent proceeding would probably address several, but not all, of the issues. And it had always been assumed that there was going to be a phase two of the trial as to damages. But Because
assumed by whom?
Well, if you read the stipulation, Your Honor, and I think I have that right here, because
the transcript from the trial where it was placed on the record.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It states that, and I'll read the whole thing, if I may, Your Honor. Ms. Anderson.
What page are you reading from, please?
This is page 20 of our brief in opposition or in answer to the petition. And it starts, Your Honor, it's, we discussed this morning about what to do with the damages portion. We've now agreed that there will not be any further proceeding for any bifurcation going forward, that in fact, this case will proceed with damages being determined for Mr. Brown. And as their class representative, that would apply to the whole class subject to any appeal. Then it goes on to say, the court then rephrases, that the figure, if any, that is arrived at for Mr. Brown will be utilized for each of the other members of the class. Is that correct? Yes, Your Honor. So this was, it was understood that it was going to be the jury's figure. Now, there was no discussion, no consideration.
But Mr. Marin, that seems to say the opposite of what you just said. So the stipulation was specifically that it wouldn't be bifurcated. So what would be left to be tried at this point?
It was in lieu of the bifurcation, Your Honor. So that instead of having to proceed to the next stage, which was the proof of damages for individual class members, which would be the natural progression, since liability was determined, and that liability was determined against the employing hospital by virtue of respondeat superior to the employee's negligence, that then we would normally go to proof of the individual damages. But what we stipulated to was that the damages that the jury awarded to Mr. Brown would apply to everybody.
And the damages to be awarded to Mr. Brown would be based on the proof Mr. Brown presented as to what his damages were, right?
Well, of course, Your Honor, that's of course true. However, that stipulation was focused on what the jury decided, not what the Supreme Court subsequently decided, because it found that SNAMS itself hadn't even been named as a proper party.
That wasn't the only basis for that ruling, counsel.
I understand that, Your Honor, and that's a separate matter as to what the effect on Mr. Brown would be.
Well, it's the matter we're talking about, because if Brown did not establish with proof damages that could be awarded, then that was the risk you took when you stipulated that they all get the same amount, isn't it?
Well, no, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that's not stated, and that was never considered. It's not on the record. There's no discussion about, well, if it goes on appeal and the court finds that Mr. Brown hasn't presented adequate proof of damages, that somehow all the rest of the class should be foreclosed. The question was, what is going to happen? What would happen if this case were remanded and it proceeded along the lines that Judge Denton said? Well, I think that one of the things that would happen is that the other class members who have already been named in the first amended complaint the second amended complaint that was filed, Your Honor, that those persons would have an opportunity to prove their damages.
Well, and some of those people actually testified in the first trial, correct?
Yes, they did, Justice Pickering. They testified at length, and I.
And then the court in its majority refused to consider that, only restricting itself to Brown. So, I'm just thinking out loud here, but there is no motion for new trial pending, nor is it clear in your estimation that such would be required. Rather, it could be handled under Rule 15. And practice with respect to claim and issue preclusion? Is that your position?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Okay. Precisely. Yes, okay. And that's what we argued below on our motion to amend, and then in support of the amended pleading that we filed.
So what would be a basis for an award in your client's favor, other if not for a new trial? How would that work?
Well, my client is a class as a whole, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And their damages have yet to be established.
How would they be established short of a trial?
Well, it would be, we would proceed to the second phase of the trial, assuming that the case was remanded and that we dealt with all the issues that could arise. We still have to figure out, and I think that Judge Denton would have to address what is going to go forward. As Justice Pickering pointed out, the issue of preclusion, these are questions that have to be resolved. But we can't do that in this forum. And I understand that we lost. I well understand that. Mm-hmm. We lost the prior appeal, but there's a whole class and their rights have to be determined. I think that just what strikes me and that this court is to do justice, and the justice in this case really demands that the members of the class who were just so horribly treated, as you know from the record, have a right to have their issues heard. And that we believe we've won on liability. What we didn't win on was the second phase of the trial, which we hadn't actually fully presented because we had the stipulation. And the stipulation, I believe, is being misconstrued because it doesn't apply to the class as a whole.
If the jury had awarded Mr. Brown $0 after the trial, would that amount have applied to all the class members?
Yes, by stipulation. Yes, it would have.
Okay. But because it was this court that determined that no evidence of damages was presented to support the award, then the stipulation doesn't apply.
Well, it was not that there was no evidence. It was not substantial, sufficiently substantial. And that's right. That stipulation did not cover that. It didn't include it. It wouldn't have been a rational thing to do, I must say, to speculate as to what would happen at the Supreme Court in relation to that or any of the other issues. Clearly, the Supreme Court could have taken one of the other issues that were raised on appeal and reversed it on that basis. I think we would still have to face all those issues that were still essentially reserved, and that includes the merits of the certification of the class and the predominance of the liability issues.
Is Mr. Brown still a class member?
Well, he is still a class member, and his rights have to be determined. And I think that it's
Isn't
very...
Isn't that what the last appeal was?
Well, in part. I think that it's possible that Mr. Brown could lose. I think that that's a reasonable interpretation, that his right, even though we didn't have a damages portion of the trial, and even though I believe, if I may say this, that if SNAMS was not a proper party, how is SNAMS then raising the issue of whether Mr. Brown pled his substantial damages or proved his substantial damages or not? How are they a proper party if the Supreme Court has said that they were never even named in those? So how are they bringing this appeal? How are they?
Because you're continuing to pursue them in spite of this court so holding.
Well, that's because we interpret the court's holding as returning this matter to the trial court, to the district court.
Where did
court.
We say that?
You reversed it without qualification. You
didn't
say
did we
enter judgment for SNAMS.
Proceedings?
You couldn't have said enter judgment for SNAMS because under your reading, SNAMS was not even a party. So how could they enter judgment? How could you enter judgment for a non-party? You couldn't do that. So recognizing that you couldn't enter judgment for them, you remanded it to reverse it. Well, what was reversed was the judgment against SNAMS and for the class. That's what was reversed. And that being the case, the district court had the jurisdiction. The Supreme Court didn't any longer after remitter. The district court had the jurisdiction to do what was correct. And I look at although it's 1909, the Frilutzi case, which talked about doing.
Counsel, time's up.
Have I mispronounced it? Time's up. I'm sorry. But I think that that's a substantial justice motion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Are there other questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple quick points. The first thing I would like to address is just the scope of that stipulation. My friend from the other side quoted that stipulation for you, and the very last line of it said, subject to any appeal. The stipulation was recognizing that the result of the trial would be subject to appeal and what this court said on appeal. So that stipulation, as it was made out to the district court, very clearly addressed that any verdict in Mr. Brown's favor might be reversed on appeal. And the reason it was reversed on appeal was that he failed to prove his damages. He stipulated that his measure of damages would serve as the measure of damages for all class members.
Has there been any motion with respect to clarifying that stipulation? Because the statement you're leaning in on was one side counsels and then the court says something slightly different. I don't see any written stipulation like a conventional.
That I'm aware of, there was not a written stipulation, but that was the stipulation that the parties reached that was represented by Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services Council. And both parties sat on the record, so stipulated.
And the district court still is empowered, if the final judgment hasn't been entered, to amend or grant a motion to amend or clarify that stipulation. Has such a motion been filed?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Okay.
The last thing that I would just point out is the majority did recognize that this case presents some pretty disturbing facts. But the fact that a case presents disturbing facts does not relieve the parties of their burden to prove their case at trial. And here, this was certified as a class. Now, the state has vehemently disagreed with whether or not this case should have been certified. But that was left alone on appeal. And this court determined that Brown stipulated away the bifurcation and the opportunity for class members to prove damages at trial.
Yeah, but could you comment on the fact that of the divergence between that? It seems to me that the majority opinion declined to consider the proof presented by the class members who testified to their harm and to focus only on Brown's. That gives me some pause about the fairness of what occurred here, especially given that there was no post-judgment motion for JNOV by your client challenging the sufficiency of the evidence under 50B. So I revert back to Rule 15, and I think that's what Judge Denton is doing. And it's a very hard case because of issues on both sides.
I understand that it's a hard case from the perspective of the underlying facts in the case.
I mean legally, that you didn't file a 50B motion. So our 50B looks just like federal 50B, and if you have a insufficiency of the evidence claim and you don't file a 50B post-judgment, I think the view is that the appellate court is hard-pressed to do anything about that because you've pulled the rug out from underneath the other side moving for a safety.
I don't think we've pulled the rug out from anybody in terms of we moved for a directed verdict that was denied, and we raised that issue on appeal, and this court decided it.
When you say you moved for a directed verdict, are you talking about during trial?
At the end, after the close of evidence, we moved for a direct.
But you didn't include in that motion a request that a challenge to the amount of the damages.
I believe that we did, Your Honor, and that's why.
And if you did not, would you agree then that your position is damaged by that?
I don't, because even this court doesn't need to rely on Rule 50E to issue the writ, because even regardless of whether or not that was adequately preserved with respect to application of Rule 50E, the court's holding on appeal is still law of the case, and the mandate rule applies, and the district court can't do anything that's inconsistent.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like Rule 15, 1-5, not 5-0, kicks in at that point.
Right.
I don't know.
All right. Thanks, counsel, for your arguments today. We appreciate your time and your arguments. This matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.